The diversity of languages is not a diversity of signs and sounds, but a diversity of views of the world. William von Humboldt. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate your support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you'll enjoy and you'll follow and subscribe and all that kind of good stuff. And you'll go back and listen to our prior episodes. And if you're a returning listener, again, thank you guys as always. And again, thank you for your continued support. I am back and refreshed after a nice long weekend last weekend. And then, of course, short work week this week helped out. But we're back into the swing of things, and we will be for the foreseeable future, I believe. So, don't really have too much feedback from last week's episode. So today we're going to be going ahead and jumping on to and continuing our overview of the Proto-Indo-European language. Also, we'll sometimes shorten that to PI, so I don't wear out my voice, just keep repeating Proto-Indo-European. But we're going to be doing our overview of the Proto-Indo-European language and the theories in relation to its emergence and its probable relation to at least one of the groups that we've been discussing this season. Now, to start, I do want to talk about comparative linguistics as a discipline. And I talked last week about William Jones and his contribution to the idea of there being PI, a Proto-Indo-European language. Now, his work was fairly theoretical. Indeed, a lot of the early work on reconstructing PI was theoretical. But this begins to change in the early 1800s when you have several people begin to take a more scientific approach to linguistics. And this, of course, eventually gives birth to the comparative method and comparative linguistics as a whole. Now, some people think this just means looking at words in different languages and seeing, oh, well, these words are similar, so these languages are all part of the same family. Now, comparing words is certainly part of comparative linguistics, but that's really just step one. You then need to compare sets of words, so things like body parts, animals, numbers, things like that. Things you know that all these languages, or all the people who spoke these languages, had in common with each other. So, if just two words happen to look alike, you know, great. But if, say, you know, all their numbers are completely different, you know, maybe they have like one number that sounds the same, but the rest are not at all the same. And they maybe have one body part that is, you know, the same, but the rest are different. That kind of throws a wrench into the, you know, whole them belonging to the same macro family. You then compare your sets of words that do match to other languages spoken contemporaneously. For instance, the Romance languages, things like French, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, these are all great, examples of how languages change because they can be compared to each other and they each have a fairly similar written record of how they evolved over time. So you have modern French, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, then you have, you know, their written languages from 200 years ago, then 400, and so on and so forth. So we have quite a large body of work to see how each changed over time. And you can see, you know, when divergences happened for certain words, or, you know, how they, you know, not just word changes, but like grammar changes and things like that. So once you have your comparison of number, or not numbers, but of words and word sets and things like that, then you can begin to kind of work backwards from there. You would come up with what you believe the sounds in the precursor, you know, language to all those may have sounded like. Now, obviously, we have Latin, you know, that all of those languages descend from, but there are breaks between, you know, Golden Age Latin and early medieval Latin, and all these vulgar languages, the language spoken by the peoples. So some of that was never written down, at least not in any large quantity. So, you know, that gave people a good way to kind of reconstruct maybe what the very earliest versions of French and Italian and Spanish and Portuguese sounded like as they became distinct from this later version of vulgar Latin. And keep in mind, this is just one example. You know, the Romance languages in Latin, obviously for Proto-Indo-European, they're doing it for a lot more. But essentially, they compared all these different branches and the earliest versions of all these branches that we had, and then they have kind of worked back to see, okay, what would have it have sounded like at the beginning? What did each of these initially come from? So then you work out your sounds or your phonemes, which is another word for sound. It's the fancy scientific version for that, that the precursor language to all these would have shared. Then once you have that kind of theoretical work, you go back and you show how each one developed into a modern version of the language. And if it doesn't work for one language, you did something wrong. So you got to go back and make sure it works for all of them. And every now and then, you know, people ran into kind of roadblocks for one and they had to figure some other stuff out. But you got to remember, they've been working on reconstructing Pi for a very long time at this point. It's over 200 years. That's a lot longer than what you get for some of the other macro families. And a lot of, you know, bigger language families today, they're doing the same thing. They're just starting it a little bit later. Now, I know this is a very gross oversimplification, but it's still a better oversimplification than some people use to make tenuous connections between languages, or what, you know, your average Joe on the street would think if you told him comparative linguistics, if you just asked him, hey, what's comparative linguistics? Now, I know some of you may ask, well, how do we know this works? Well, reconstructions have been proven several times, as a matter of fact. Mycenaean Greek was theoretically reconstructed. And then, of course, the Linear B script, which Mycenaean Greek was written down in. But that was deciphered in the 1950s, and it showed that the theoretical reconstruction was very accurate. Proto-Germanic has been reconstructed, and extremely old runes have been found showing that reconstructions for Proto-Germanic were correct. Another big one is Hittite, the Hittite language, which we will be discussing more later this episode. When it was discovered, it proved several very long-standing theories about Pi, like it having laryngeal consonants that other Proto-Indo-European daughter tongues have dropped. Oh, and the laryngeal consonant is just like, it's like a guttural sound. It's like the break in uh-oh, like that little uh-oh, the little uh-oh, which, again, not very common in Indo-European languages today. That's something that disappeared from most of them. Well, I say early on, at least in a later period. But we'll talk more about Hittite in just a second. Should also point out that some of this stuff is always going to be theoretical. They have guesses, and you know, there's almost always exceptions to rules in every language. Excuse me, I'm having trouble speaking right now. But so some of this we can't really know. It's just what they, you know, what they think is the case. But then there is some stuff they're very sure about. For instance, we can say pretty definitively that Indo-European had two vowels, E and O, and 25 consonants, including three different ways to pronounce H. Then it has eight or nine noun cases. Again, it's debated. We believe it was subject, object, verb, though some people argue that it is subject, verb, object. And then also, almost always, the adjective comes before the noun. It is also gendered language. It has three genders, masculine, feminine, and neuter. And, you know, it had a lot of different verb forms, just like you would probably expect from, you know, all of modern Indo-European language descendants. Now, before we kind of continue, I am going to read a reconstruction that was done initially in the 1860s, I believe. It was done by a German, August Schleicher. And I'm going to read it, and then you can kind of maybe try and guess what it's referring to. I'm not great at the Proto-Indo-European pronunciation, but I'm going to try. Now, this is not Schleicher's original version. This is one, because again, people have tweaked this over time, you know, using new reconstructions or using new phonemes, I guess, for the same reconstruction that he did initially. And I'm not going to tell you what it's about. I just want to see, I'm just going to read it and see maybe if you might kind of have an idea of what it may be talking about. You probably won't, but you might recognize a random word or two. And this is based on a translation by Bird in 2013. And this is, again, hit the most current one I could find of Schleicher's fable. Huus equosque hoewe hoisme huluna ne hest so equomos dert so quorum uquum uquited so mecum borum so degemonum hocu bered hos hequis oibus es uequid de hemnum specio hequumus que hagete cur moi ag unutor hequus tu iuequand clod he honoe tod specimonus nesme ac nutor cur de gemo potis se hois hula guermon ustum upt haoibuios tu ha ulna ne este tod kecluros hois hagorum buchid. So yeah, that's my very, very terrible attempt to pronounce that. But essentially, this is known as the sheep and the horses. And I'm going to read what the English translation of this would be. A sheep that has no wool saw horses. One of them was pulling a heavy wagon, one carrying a big load and one carrying a man quickly. The sheep said to the horses, "My heart pains me, seeing a man driving horses." The horse said, "Listen, sheep, our hearts pain us when we see this. A man, the master, makes the wool of the sheep into a warm garment for himself, and the sheep has no wool." Having heard this, the sheep fled into the plain. So, there you have it. That's just a very early reconstruction done. That's a modern translation reconstruction, I should say, from an earlier reconstruction. And the first one done by Schleicher is a little bit easier to read, and I'll give you that one. It's Avis akvasas ka, avis jasmin varna na a est, dadarka akvams tam, vagham garum, vaghatam tam, baharam magam tam, manum aku barantam, avis akvaba jams, vavakat card, agnutai mai vidanti manum, akvams agantam, akvasis a vavakant, crudi avai card agnutai vi vivant svas manus patis varnum av sams carnauti svabamjam garmnum vastra av biv hamjams kavarna na asti tat cuc ruvantis avis agam a bugat. So it's much easier to read that early translation because there's less pronunciation notation in that. There's less like accent marks. And again, I think that was his initial reconstructions before they determined that the H could be pronounced with so many, three different versions of the H sound. So, and, you know, people have basically gone back every couple of decades and, like, updated that reconstruction. Basically, anytime there's a big new breakthrough in Proto-Indo-European reconstruction, someone goes back and updates that. You can find it online. It's Schleicher's Fable. You can go back and read a number of different versions for it, if you're so interested. All right, so now we've gotten kind of the overview of the language itself, at least what we know from reconstructions, and we're going to talk about the theories involving that and its emergence. Apologies for the odd edit there. I was having some technical issues for a second, was able to get it fixed, but may have cut off a little bit of what I said towards the end there, so apologies for that. Now, the subject of the Indo-European homeland is a little bit controversial. In fact, it's a lot controversial, especially among academics. You know, you have various schools of thought between archaeologists, geneticists, linguists. You know, each of those fields has their own internal debates, and then you have the debates between each of those fields themselves. And, you know, there's some overlap between all of them, but, you know, there's also differences between, you know, which theories ascended among which group at which time. So just keep that in mind. I'm going to do my best to kind of lay it out as, you know, as concisely as I can and give you kind of the current popular theories. Now, of course, there's also added controversy due to, you know, scientific racism back in the, you know, 1700s to, of course, today. Various nationalistic or right-wing groups have attempted to, you know, make some sort of statement about ethnic or racial purity of, you know, European groups, why they may be superior to others. Obviously, that was a big deal among the Nazis and then, you know, in Germany. But that also led to a little bit of a backlash among certain left-wing individuals and groups. And in fact, today, fairly recently, within the last year or two, I read a paper that someone had published in a nominally scientific magazine, basically saying, oh, Indo-Europeans didn't exist. This is completely made up, and they're, you know, there is no deep tie between these various Indo-European peoples. I'll just say, you know, if a person, you know, thinks this, most likely they're either willfully ignorant or they're saying this to discredit modern-day political adversaries. You should take those people about as seriously as you take the right-wing version of, you know, the Indo-European people are great. You know, basically, you should take them as seriously as you take, like, a right-wing extremist. They're just left-wing extremists. They're the same size of, or different sides of the same cloth, or coin, or whatever you want to call it. So, just feel free to ignore them the same way you would, you know, people believing that that they're ethnically pure, or that they have no, that they have no faults, or that they're, you know, 1,000 times better than any other race because of the language they speak. As we'll see, it's not very clear, you know, how closely related some of the early Indo-European groups are to each other. And we'll get into that. We're going to talk about the Hittites here shortly. But yeah, so just if you see someone saying that, you can safely ignore them. They're either an idiot or they're just spreading their own propaganda. And I'll hope you'll do the same for the right-wing version of the Proto-Indo-European debate. You know, they're racially pure and they're spreading a superior culture. As we'll see, that's not at all what's happening. So, yeah, left-wing, right-wing extremists, safely ignored, please. In this case, I'm going to be a radical centrist on this issue. So I'm only going to go over the three most popular theories today. In the past, this is different. And all of these, in some cases, there is overlap between some of these. And, you know, I'll kind of point out where they think maybe the changes happened between these groups. In some cases, you know, these areas all overlap with each other, the potential homeland for the modern theories. So it's just a question of, well, which area did they show up first? Was there back migration? How many people is this, are we actually talking about here? That kind of thing. So I'll kind of try and, you know, I'll give like broad overviews for each theory, and then I'm going to try and talk about the points in between them and the strengths and weaknesses for each argument. I will say in the past, there was, at least initially, for some of the more atheistic parts of the latter bit of the Enlightenment, that India was the homeland of Proto-Indo-European. They very much liked that theory because, again, of words like we quoted from William Johnson last time when he talked about how Sanskrit was so pure, you know, they were thinking, you know, well, India, you know, it's not in the Bible at all. It's great. There's no Christian influences. There's no Jewish influences. There's no Middle Eastern influences. You know, and for a large portion of the more atheistic side of the Enlightenment, they were very much wanting to do away with a lot of like biblical scholarship and thinking about history and the nature of the world and all that kind of thing. So, They were very big on India being the homeland. No one today, with the exception of extreme Hindu nationalists, interestingly enough, put forward that India was the Indo-European homeland. So, just putting that out there. But we'll get back to that argument later. Also, those same interestingly enough, those same Enlightenment thinkers think that they were responsible. The original Proto-Indo-Europeans were the ones responsible for destroying the Indus Valley civilization. Hindu nationalists do not think that. They think they were the Indus Valley civilization. Obviously, they don't want, you know, their ancestors having to destroy themselves. But we'll get in more into that when we talk about the end of the Indus Valley civilization. So today, the most popular theory is the Kurgan or the steppe hypothesis. I mentioned Kurgans a couple of weeks ago when we talked about their emergence in steppe burials. But that is, again, the most widely accepted homeland right now, at least among academics. Also, you'll sometimes hear this called the Pontic-Caspian steppe hypothesis, and that's exactly what the name implies. They emerge somewhere on the Eurasian steppe between the Pontic and Caspian Sea, or the Black and the Caspian Sea. This was first put forward in the 1880s. I think it was a German. I think his name was Otto Schrader. Now, his version of the theory was a little bit different from what came later. V. Corton Child also supported this theory in the 1920s. But it was really systematized and kind of, you know, all the more recent excavations and stuff was really initially put forward by Maria Gimbutas. Now, I've talked about her, I believe, in the past. I think I've mentioned her back in season 2 and 3. But she was a very important and very influential archaeologist. She's one of the ones that put forward the theory that the Proto-Indo-Europeans people came into the old Europe, the old Mesolithic Europe, and they overthrew this mother goddess matriarchal society and replaced it with the patriarchal Proto-Indo-European society. And again, this was, I think, in 1956 when she kind of put this theory out there in a more systematized way. Now, at the time, this was extremely controversial because, again, in the 1950s, there was still a lot of backlash due to the Nazis and things like that. A real stigma held kind of lingered on Indo-European studies in a lot of fields. she had lived, she was Lithuanian. She lived in Lithuania during the Nazi occupation, as well as briefly during the Soviets. When the Soviets were coming back into Lithuania after they were pushing the Russians back, she and her family, they went through Nazi lines and then escaped into Austria and Bavaria. And then she worked her way west to the U.S. eventually to escape the communists. But she believed that the Kurgan culture, which again, as we've discussed, there are a couple of archaeological cultures that we know today that had Kurgans, but the biggest one's going to be the Yamnaya. We'll talk about them next season. That they basically spread they spread with the help of their horses and their cattle. Their high mobility allowed them to spread out, you know, move in different directions and kind of spread their corded ware pottery, their knowledge of horse riding and horse training and chariots, that kind of thing, as well as some level of metallurgy as well. And again, she believed that they were responsible for spreading like patriarchal culture into Europe as opposed to the more egalitarian and matrilineal inclined old European Mesolithic and early Neolithic farmers. Then the second big theory you have, it was initially proposed by Colin Renfrew. I think he initially put this forward in the 1980s. And he knew Maria Kambutis. They were friends. But he believed that the Indo-European languages spread into Europe from Anatolia from around 7000 BC with the spread of agriculture from Anatolia into Europe. Now, the last theory is the Armenian or the Irano-Armenian hypothesis, also sometimes known as the Southern Hypothesis. This is this is a newer theory, and it's mostly based on genetic evidence. And it's been kind of bandied about by a few people. I think the most recent person that kind of really big name attached to it is David Reich, the geneticist. He's extremely, you know, famous in the genetic field. But, you know, the other people have kind of saying, well, wait, he might be onto something here. But it is not widely accepted because for his, I'll hold off on that. But so those are the three big hypotheses or hypothesi of where Proto-Indo-European emerged from. Now, part of the reason that the steppe hypothesis is so popular is because of horses. A lot of the Indo-European shared vocabulary, you know, in all these daughter languages that are similar comes from things that you would expect from a herding society, people that were very big on animals. Horse, sheep, ewes, equus for horses, boss for cows, all of that shows up very heavily. There's a lot more terms for relatives in relation to your father than there are in terms of relatives in relation to your mother. And, you know, there are, you know, you have uncles that are much more important than your aunts, at least in, you know, that's what you kind of see. So you would expect them to be somewhat patriarchal, more reliant on animals that you would find in the steppe versus some of these other places. There's not as much of a shared vocabulary for plants. There's more loan words in certain languages for certain types of plants than others, which shows that they were introduced into the languages at different points, or at later points, at different and later points, I guess, is the best way to say that. They also, they had a word for honey, but not a word for bee, which means they didn't have bees. Honey was just something they traded for. So, you know, in the Middle East, in Anatolia, the Caucasus, bees were present. They knew that's where honey came from. So that's probably something that came in a little bit later. So these are all part of the reason that the steppe hypothesis is so widely accepted. Also, there's the genetic evidence. There's a lot of the earliest versions of patrilineal descent comes from populations that are most heavily noticed in the steppe, R1A, R1B. If you want to look those up, you can Google those. You can find out what they are in terms of like patrilineal descent. So that's all kind of tied in. They think that all of this kind of spread based upon these family lines in the steppe. Now, the Anatolian hypothesis has other issues. From Colin Renfrew's initial assumption that, you know, Anatolian is the homeland and that it emerged in 7000 BC, that's an extremely early date. Most linguists place Proto-Indo-European at 4500. You'll see some that are 5000. You'll see some that are even as early as 5500. But that's an extremely small group of linguists that think Indo-Europeans that old. Now, Renfrew's initial argument when he first proposed the Anatolian hypothesis was very, you know, we'll just say he didn't put a lot of stock in some of the reconstruction work done in linguistics. His famous response was that you know, you can't really compare reconstructions to a theory that the presence of the word cafe in all modern Romance language implied that the Romans had cafes too. But a big rejoinder from people that do support the steppe hypothesis at the time was, well, you're saying that the Hittites, or the Proto-Indo-Europeans, moved into Europe from Anatolia. The problem with that was that there were a number of other languages spoken by non-Indo-European speaking peoples. So there was this big pocket between the Hittites, who are maybe a Proto-Indo-European speaking people, and the Indo-European speaking peoples on the coast. There's basically these pockets of people known as the Hattians, who we think were maybe speaking a Caucasian language. The Chablis, who we don't even know, you know, much about that language. It's completely uncategorized. And the Hurrians, which were like a Urartian language that were spoken kind of on the southern coast of Anatolia, you know, in the distant past. So his theory, you know, it has some value, but it didn't explain, well, why, if this language was so dynamic, why didn't it overtake those languages, and why did it spread so easily into Europe? Now, that brings in the case of David Reich's argument. He has done a lot of genetic studies, especially of some early Hittite burials. His belief is that Indo-European was spoken around 4000 BC, somewhere in what is now kind of the Armenian highlands, and that it would have split off very early, with one group going into the steppe and another going into Anatolia, and that would become the Hittites. Because the Hittites, interestingly enough, do not share steppe ancestry, at least from the remains that have been found and studied today. There are no, there's no steppe peoples that would have conceivably brought Indo-European into Anatolia from the Pontic-Caspian steppe. Now, again, we're working with a very limited number of remains, but the fact that none of them has any steppe ancestry is very interesting. Now, this brings us to another theory. What if Hittite is not Proto-Indo-European? It's not a daughter language of Proto-Indo-European, but perhaps it is a sister language of Proto-Indo-European. So there was a Proto-Indo-European, and Pi split off, and Anatolian split off from that language. Now, I will say, Colin Renfrew in 2015, after, you know, more DNA evidence had been done, he has acknowledged that Maria Kambutas got the right of it. And they were friends in real life, or in real life. They were friends. They collaborated a lot. He has come around to her point of view. And Hittite's a very interesting example, because if you look at some Indo-European myths, there are similarities between Hittite myth and Proto-Indo-European myths, but they're missing the element of horses. So it is possible, at least in the earliest versions, they are missing the horse element. There is a famous, just to kind of give a rough overview of a popular Indo-European myth, and you might recognize it, but there is a fertility god or goddess in some cases that goes missing, that something happens that's preventing them from having spring essentially, and you know, the world is essentially tied up in famine and all that kind of stuff. Now in the Hittite myth, the god of fertility is taking, he's fallen asleep, and he's attacked by a bee, which again, Proto-Indo-European, they didn't have a word for bee, at least initially. This bee stings him, he goes on a rampage, that makes things even worse, and, he's eventually, returned to his role as a figure. Now, in other Indo-European myths, it is a goddess. Her daughter has been taken by someone on horseback, and you know, she's walking around searching for him. But eventually, you know, she's reunited with her daughter, at least on a temporary basis. That Greek myth as the myth of Hades abducting Persephone and her mother Demeter. Searching frantically to find her and not performing her duties as a harvest goddess. Of course, they're reunited for a few months every year, and then Persephone returns to the underworld while Demeter kind of goes into this melon colony that prevents things from growing. So, now another problem with the Arminian hypothesis is kind of tied into that. The steppe herders that the popular theory is that spread pie, they don't have any Neolithic Iranian or Armenian farmers. They're not getting their Caucasian DNA from those groups, which is what Reich initially was suggesting. They only have Caucasian hunter-gatherers. Now, it's possible that that some of these Iranian / Armenian hunter-gatherers had at one point been descendants from people who had first practiced agriculture in the Iranian plateau. And maybe it wasn't as easy or not as productive as just herding, so they may have forgotten their agricultural roots, as it were. So that is one theory. Also, there could just be the fact that there is a lot of continued trade between the steppe and the Caucasus, and that kind of kept language transfer between various pie groups open. But that's all stuff to kind of keep in mind. Eventually, you know, we may find more remains from the Hittite period to test for DNA. But right now, by and large, most academics agree that the steppe hypothesis is the likely origin point for Proto-Indo-European, which, again, it's emerging right towards the end of this season at the latest. 4,500, 4,000 is really when it begins to start to spread, especially with the Yamnaya people, which we'll get back to. So I just wanted to put those theories out there, let you guys know in terms of, I just wanted you to be aware of those and say that, you know, at somewhere in the places we've talked about this season, Proto-Indo-European is being spoken. It's probably not being spoken by a huge number, maybe only a couple of hundred, and then it will begin to spread over the course of next season, especially in all directions. So just wanted to put that out there as part of the theory. And for this, I guess to kind of conclude the episode, we will begin with the reconstructed Proto-European creation myth, as we kind of did with the Sumerians and some of the other creation myths we've talked about this season. So in the beginning, there was nothing. There was no earth, no sky, no tree, no hill, no sea, no stars, nor sun, nor moon, or anything like that. Instead, you have a man, or the man, the first man, Manu, and his brother, Yimo, who is a, in some versions, a giant. Some reconstructed version, he's considered a giant. And Manu sacrifices his brother, and with the help of the heavenly gods, Sky Father, the Storm God, and two divine twins, they begin to forge the world from the remains of Yimu. You may recognize that name. It shows up as Ymir in Norse myth. He's the giant that Odin killed along with his brothers to create the world. And then after Manu sacrifices his brother, he is installed essentially as the first priest. So, whenever someone is sacrificing something, or whenever a priest is sacrificing something to God, he is renewing, this act of creation. He's keeping the world in its current state. He's preserving the world. Then you have the third man, Trito, and he was given a cow as a divine gift, but it is then stolen by a serpent, Nikwe. Nikwi in the initial version of the myth, and it's serpent, but it can also be the negation. Essentially, this cattle that is meant to continue this sacrifice that Yimu initially provided is taken. So Trito has to go and reclaim this cattle from this serpent, and you'll see in a lot of Indo-European myths. A hero destroying a large serpent, or in some cases later on, a dragon, something fiercer than just your standard snake. So this myth will show up in several different ways. And Trito becomes the first warrior. Manu is the first king. Yimu is the first sacrifice. And Trito is the first warrior. So the warrior goes out, procures the sacrifice, and brings it back to the priest, who then offers it up to the gods, and that keeps kind of a cosmic balance. So that's kind of the very rough outline of the myth. Obviously, we don't know what the exact myth was, but that's what comparative mythology has kind of given us from these collection of Indo-European folk tales and myths and things like that. So, I think that will do it for this week. We will be continuing on next week into Southern Europe, the Balkans, that kind of area. And then we'll be moving on probably back into Anatolia, the western portion. So kind of keep all these ideas in mind as we go back and talk. Maybe you guys will make some more connections that I've missed, or maybe I'll make the connections that I may have missed previously, and we'll continue on and finish up Europe, and then we'll be going over to the Americas for this season. So I hope you guys have enjoyed this episode. Please like, rate 5 stars, download, all that kind of good stuff, kind of help the channel grow, and I hope you've enjoyed. I hope you've had a good listen. And I hope to see you guys next week. Until then, hope you have a good rest of your day or week from whenever you're listening to this. And I'll see y'all next time. Peace.